We're going to be looking at an overview of the book of Proverbs. We've been looking at the books of wisdom over the last few weeks, and the book of Job and the book of Psalms. In each of these cases, there's so much material to cover, and certainly we could take them piece by piece. And especially in the Psalms, for instance, each psalm is meant to be taken on its own. If we do that with the book of Proverbs, taking each unit on its own, the units get down to one verse. And so you might even spend longer there than you would in the Psalms. Though, of course, as we'll see, a lot of those verses end up repeated, and even more so the ideas end up being repeated. And I think there's some purpose to that that we'll talk about as we go along. The book of Proverbs, as we open up the first page, just really gives us a good summary. It introduces itself, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. And of course, most of them are from Solomon. That's where the author of most of these Proverbs. There are a few other authors as we get towards the end of the book. But he says this, beginning in verse 2, to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the naive, to the youth knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. And I'm just going to add this next verse. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. So right there at the beginning, he says, here's the purpose. Here's what I'm writing about. And then right on the heels of that, he gives sort of the foundations of everything. Not just wisdom, but the wisdom that begins with God, the wisdom that begins with a belief in God, with a confidence in God. And I want to talk some about that as we go through. The need for us to have confidence in the Proverbs, even though they are Proverbs, and what that means. And we'll get to that in just a moment. It is a book that is not quoted as often in the New Testament as the Psalms, or as maybe Isaiah, for instance, which are just thoroughly quoted in the New Testament. But maybe it's quoted more often than we realize. I think because of the way it's quoted, it's often quoted in snippets. You know, just even a phrase, a half of a proverb. You know, just take the second half of one of the verses of Proverbs, and it'll insert it into something that they're saying. And so maybe we miss it sometimes. Over in the book of Romans is maybe some of the more well-known quotations, some of the ones that maybe we've traced down from time to time. Chapter 2 and verse 6 of the book of Romans says, who will render to each person according to his deeds. This is found over in Proverbs chapter 24, and you might just keep a marker over there in Proverbs. That's where we'll be spending really most of our time after we make a few observations here from the New Testament. But Proverbs chapter 24, and there in verse 12, he says, if you say, see, we did not know this, does he not consider it who weighs the hearts? And does he not know it who keeps your souls? And will he not render to man according to his work? And if you have a translation that indicates a quote, you'll see that quoted there in Romans chapter 2 and verse 6. While we're back in Proverbs, let's just go ahead and turn over one page to Proverbs 25. In Proverbs 25 and in verse 21, if your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. If he is thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Well, of course, that's Romans chapter 12 and in verse 20. And I'm sure that one particularly sounds familiar. One of the things that I think, I was talking about this with the junior high classes, we're going through the wisdom literature. I think that when we see those New Testament quotations, one of the things that it ought to say to us is that those New Testament writers and the speakers, when it's speakers being quoted, we're speaking with these quotations, assuming their audiences would get the reference. Are we familiar enough with God's Word, old and new, that when we read the New Testament, which we're more familiar with than the Old Testament a lot of times, that we get the reference. And sometimes we won't. And we have aids, we have helps in there with references, cross-references to point us back. But what we want to do is be building that. Be building that cross-reference so that as we're reading through, oh, yes, there's a reference to that old piece of wisdom, that old wise saying. There's also not just quotations, but there's also more building teaching upon the Proverbs. Look over at Proverbs chapter 25. We're already there, back to the beginning of the chapter in verse 6. Proverbs 25 and verse 6. Do not claim honor in the presence of the king, and do not stand in the place of great men. For it is better that it be said to you, come up here, than for you to be placed lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen. Does that sound familiar? Well, of course, Jesus in Luke chapter 14 gave a short parable about where you sit and sit further back so that the host might tell you to move up to a greater place of honor rather than being humiliated by being put further back. And so Jesus is teaching, you can see it being built on the wisdom that has already been revealed. And that is so often the case. I think we have places like Matthew chapter 5 and people seem to indicate that Jesus comes in saying things no one's ever said. No, he's reminding them of things that they have not paid very good attention to so very often. And he's pulling out things that were already there, truth that has already been revealed. I do think more things are being revealed, don't get me wrong. But I think so often Jesus is building his instruction on what has already been revealed. Over in Proverbs chapter 3, and in verse 34, no, Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 11. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe his reproof. For whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father corrects the son in whom he delights. If I were to just read that to you and say, where's that from? I think most of us would say, well, Hebrews chapter 12. Well, where did he get it? You know, that's sort of the thing we ought to be asking. He built it on top of what was already revealed. Isn't that interesting how often the Hebrew writer builds his instruction off of an Old Testament that he is saying Jesus is better than? He's not saying Jesus is better than the Old Testament in that we do away with the Old Testament. Rather, it fulfills. And so we understand that. Over in Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 34 now. Proverbs 3 and verse 34. This one, the verbiage is a little bit different, but it says, he scoffs at the scoffers and he gives grace to the afflicted. Well, in the New Testament, it would say that he gives grace to the humble. And it would say that both in James chapter 4 and verse 6 and 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 5. And this would be a closer quotation of the Septuagint translation of the Proverbs. We'll see that more pointedly in another one of the quotations. Over in chapter 10, Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12. It says there, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions. Or to put it in Peter's verbiage or quotation of this, love covers a multitude of sins. And so he reaches back and grabs that principle from the book of Proverbs that love is the thing that will, I believe what he's saying, keep us back from so many sins that we might commit. Over in Proverbs chapter 26, Proverbs chapter 26 and in verse 11, like a dog that returns to its vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. And in fact, in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 22, that's what he says. The proverb is true, or the proverb has come true. And he points back. And so he lets us know where he's getting that from. And then over in Proverbs chapter 11. Proverbs chapter 11 and in verse 31. It says, if the righteous will be rewarded in the earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner? That one may not sound familiar. Let me read it from the Septuagint. If the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? Well, that's 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. Again, making a quotation from the Septuagint version of this. Incidentally, there's some help. Not only in the Proverbs, we get this in the Psalms a lot as well, where the New Testament writer will pull a psalm or proverb forward or quotation from there. They pull it forward, and it's different. I mean, sometimes it feels a lot different. Then we do some investigation. We may find it's not so different. Maybe what we thought it meant in the original Hebrew, maybe that helps us understand. Maybe that's not quite what it meant. And then I trust the New Testament writers to help us to interpret some of those proverbs. Incidentally, we need some help on some of them. Some of them are obscure, and we'll talk about that as we go along. So there's some connectivity between the Proverbs and the New Testament. They do, not as thoroughly, but certainly to a significant extent, and maybe more so than we've given credit always. Well, I want to begin with some observations about the book of Proverbs that I think are important. Maybe some common sense as we approach the book. Because I think sometimes there are certain places in Scripture where, like, we would read no other words in the world like we read these words. You may say, well, that's right, because these are the words of God. I understand that. But God is communicating to us in the same ways we communicate with each other. And we need to understand that. And in works of poetry, he's using figures of speech. He's using all the same ways that we communicate with each other. And he's communicating to us. And people sort of throw some of that out the window when they come to some of God's words. And they forget this is human communication. And so what are some things we need to keep in mind? Well, first of all, exceptions don't disprove true observations. Just because you can go and find an exception to something that a true observation that someone has made doesn't mean that their observation is no longer true. One of the ones that I think about in terms of this is if someone were to say, cigarettes cause cancer. Have you ever heard someone say, well, my granddaddy smoked his whole life and he never got cancer. And he lived till he was 96 years old. Okay. All right. Or maybe they'll throw in the converse. I knew someone got lung cancer and they never smoked in their life. Okay. Are you saying you're going to throw out all of this data that just unequivocally proves the connection between smoking and cancer because you've got someone who didn't get cancer? But it's still true. It's still a true observation. I think about that in terms, maybe a more modern example, the constant call of the danger of texting and driving. And what happens? Every time someone texts and drives and gets safely where they're headed, they think, well, it's not real. It's not true. I can do it at least. I'm able to multitask. And so it builds, those exceptions begin to push back against the true observation. Let me just tell you, it's dangerous. And the statistics, again, will show you. And if someone were actually to give you tests while you're texting and driving, you would find your capacity is diminished considerably. And yet, how many people believe the exception over the reality? Texting and driving is dangerous. And it's the same thing with the Proverbs. People live, and they live with exceptions, and they're proof of the exceptions, and they think that their exception overrides the wisdom of God. How sad that people think that their lives are proof that God does not know better than us. No, we're going to keep trusting God. I think that they are much more certain in the ultimate sense than they are in the everyday sense. That is, that there are, especially when it talks about consequences, for instance, this is what will happen to this kind of person. This is what will happen to this kind of person. Well, at the end of any given day, that may not hold true. In fact, at the end of a lot of days, because we see fools prospering, we see wise people in the poorhouse, and so it doesn't look like it's working out. And in so many of those cases, what God is saying, trust me, in the end, this is what that will look like. This is the ultimate consequence of either this path or this path. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. It's interesting. The Proverbs do not speak with that sort of uncertainty of maybe, perhaps, could be. Everything's definitive in Proverbs. This is the way this works. This is the way this works. But you got to understand from the standpoint of, yes, you're headed in that direction. Or, yes, you're headed in that direction. And so ultimately, where's that going to lead to? And that's more of the sense, I think, that we should take most of the Proverbs in. They are memorable rather than exhaustive. What I mean by this is Solomon is not covering literally every area of life. But rather what he's doing is trying to phrase things in a way that you can kind of tuck that away. We talked about that with the Psalms, that songs are written so that you'll remember things. Proverbs are written that way. They're written cleverly. They're written ironically sometimes, but they're written in a way to kind of plant something in your mind. And of course, here it's a father planting things in his son's mind. You may not find everything addressed, but it's to give you some principles. I will say this about that a lot of times, even if what you're looking for, especially you do a concordance search and you're not going to find what you're looking for in Proverbs, you might find a proverb that in principle addresses what you're thinking about. Maybe not specifically, but there's some taking that and applying it more broadly than just in the case. I mean, an example that almost we almost would not apply it in a literal sense, maybe to some degree. But the idea of winking eyes, just look up winking eyes in Proverbs. It's like, no good comes from winking eyes. Yeah, well, I mean, well, that sounds a bit harsh. It's the idea of people who are passing signals, people who are doing things on the sly and keeping things secret from others, and the plotting that goes on. Yes, that's what leads to ruin. It's not literally winking eyes, but then how far out could you take that? You see, you can apply that more broadly than just the winking eyes. In fact, if you only applied it to the winking eyes, you're doing it totally wrong. Because if it's the next time you see somebody wink, you go, ha ha, I know what you're up to. No. That's not what that is. You take it and you expand it out and you apply it more broadly. Again, they often use imagery over in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 7. The highway of the upright is to depart from evil. He who watches his way will preserve life. It's not that the wicked have gone out and engaged in road construction. You know, they're on this path. And it's not a literal path. It's just a general way of life that they are in. And so that's a small piece of imagery. It gets more thick than that in other places. They're sometimes sardonic or sarcastic. That is sort of derisive at a principle. So they might say something, and the first time you read it, you think, well, that doesn't sound true. So Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 8 is an example. A bribe is a charm in the sight of its owner. Wherever he turns, he prospers. People who take bribes prosper? Well, sort of, right? Or the person maybe who gives bribes, and I think that's really the point here. The one who's got bribes to give, yeah, he's able to grease palms. But the idea is not here to uphold bribery. It's the idea of, sure, yeah, he gets whatever he wants. And I think there's a little bit of sarcasm there. There's sort of a derisive, sure. And you may find some proverbs that seem to indicate that. And you'll understand because they'll be jolting. You'll read that and do a double take. You read it in context. Okay, this must be on the other end. This must be the sarcastic approach. And then some are obscure. This is something we just have to come to grips with. A lot of times we talk about the Bible being simple to understand. It is, for the most part, but not all of it. And particularly when we're talking about cultural references like you have in the Proverbs. We talked about farming this morning. We have to think through some of those illustrations. It is heartbreaking, some of the things that we have to explain to our kids, is it not? You make an illustration and include a reference to a payphone, and your kids just kind of stare at you. A what? You know, these phones that are on the side of the... Why would people need phones on the side of the road? Okay, let me explain some things. And so you have to go back. Well, look, we're far more removed from Proverbs and what they're talking about than we are from payphones. And already we have to explain things like that. There are some things we're going to have to do a lot of work to dig out and try to figure out what's going on with some of these proverbs. And so just to understand that, when you come to some of them, you go, I don't know what that's saying. Okay, got some research to do. That may take some time and effort. What do these animals mean? What do these symbols mean? And all of that takes time. So that's just some observations about the Proverbs. Having said all that, it's a very approachable book. It is. I mean, as far as practical, getting something from it in the immediate, you don't even have to have a lot of background in biblical knowledge to be able to open up the book of Proverbs, start reading, and see the value and the wisdom of the Proverbs. It's one of the reasons why when people are saying, I've never been regular in my Bible reading, where should I start? It very frequently, either the Psalms or the Proverbs. Very approachable, very relatable to what people are going through in their day-to-day lives. It's not, though, just written from the standpoint of merely self-help, practical wisdom. I think it goes beyond that. And I want to notice some of the major themes that we can see through the book of Proverbs that help us see the depth of what the writer has to say here. To begin with, overarching is wisdom. I'm not even going to spend very much time on that. That permeates everything. Right? Everything is about wisdom. The whole first 9 chapters really are an exaltation of wisdom. About, you know, the consequences of not listening to wisdom, the rewards of listening to wisdom, and the appeal over and over, please do listen to wisdom. And so everything is really written from the standpoint of pay attention to what is wise. Again, as we read those first few verses, that's the whole point. Acquire wisdom. Get it. Hold on to it. And so, in that vein, one of the major themes is pointing out the opposite. That is the fool. The man who not only does not have it, but will reject it. And will very actively reject it. And so from the very beginning, in the first chapter, in verse 22, how long, O naive ones, will you be simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. Now understand, that's 3 different people being mentioned. And the first one in particular, the naive ones who love being simple-minded, I think they get placed in a different category. And I think there is hope for the naive all the way back at the first chapter as you go through. There's hope for the naive. There is no hope for the fool. Here is a man who is not just, it's not just he needs information. He's already rejected information. Violently will reject information. And he will do everything he can to not learn, not from his mistakes, not from his successes. There's nothing that you can do, it seems, to get through to this man. And he is presented as the worst villain. We use fool in a very lighthearted way. We talk about foolishness as sort of just silly, sort of comical. That's what we think of as foolishness. This is wickedness. And it is wickedness of the worst sort. And the wickedness is defined as a total rejection. Here is a person who will never welcome correction. Who will always turn and bite at every correction. Avoid it at all costs. Here is a person who will not exercise self-control. Here is a person who will betray himself at every turn by his words. By how many of them he speaks. By how foolish they are when he does speak. Here is a person who will, if at all possible, take the worst possible path. I mean, if it's available, he will take the foolish path. And the consequences are spelled out. Again and again, the consequences are destruction. And all the things that attend that. Embarrassment to your parents. Embarrassment to yourself. Ultimately, destruction is what is in line for the fool. But he doesn't just point at the fool, he points at the people who must live around the fool. And we all must. Because there's a world full of them. And sometimes it's even the guy looking at us in the mirror. And so we've got to figure out how do we approach the fool? And there's some balanced advice on that. How do you deal with that? There's 2 verses in a row that says, one, don't answer the fool according to his folly. And then the very next verse, answer the fool according to his folly, essentially. And so one is like, you know, don't get into an argument with a fool. And the next one is, but somebody's got to stand up and say something to that guy. And there's some balance in figuring out which one of those we must do at any given time. But notice what it says over in chapter 17 and verse 12. Let a man meet a bear robbed of her cubs rather than a fool in his folly. I think the general advice is run. Just get away. It's not the sorts of people we want to be around. You think of the extremeness. We live in a world where lots of people talk in the extreme. The Proverbs exaggerate with purpose. And so he says, I'd rather come up on a wild animal that would tear me to shreds than a fool. That's pretty serious. And so we keep our distance. And we want to take care about that person. Again, remember who this person is. The person wants nothing to do with anything that has to do with God. The psalmist would point that out more clearly. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now, of course, we read in verse 7 of chapter 1, there's an element of that here too. That the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. What does the fool do? He rejects knowledge. And so he has rejected God. That's who this man is. Keep your distance. Another negative character who I think makes a frequent appearance is the sluggard. Again, we realize the sluggard being mentioned, but I wonder if we see how often he's mentioned. And the virtue of work that is implied by how often the sluggard is mentioned. Here is a man who will not take advantage of opportunities, though they fall into his very lap. All he would need to do is respond. All he needs to do is get out of bed, and he won't do that. We see that he makes excuses for his laziness. There's a lion out there in the road somewhere on the planet. And so I'm going to stay here in my bed. And that's the sort of thing that he does. Maybe something might happen that could be bad. I'll just stay here. He spends most of his time, it tells us, sleeping. Over in chapter 6 and in verse 10, Proverbs chapter 6 and in verse 10, he says there, a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. Your poverty will come in like a vagabond and your need like an armed man. You just keep on sleeping and you will lose it all. Over in chapter 26 and in verse 14 then, here is the activity. As the door turns on its hinges, so does the sluggard in his bed. This is the activity he engages in. You know what's bad is that the sluggard today, I think very often, doesn't even get the advantage of rest. At least this guy sleeps every once in a while. We don't fold our hands around a pillow. We fold it around a video controller or a remote control. And then we'll just spin the hours away. And an hour, 2 hours, 8 hours of the day gone. And where did they go? To what profit? What do you have at the end of the day? What have you gained at the end of the day? What have you lost at the end of the day? I'll tell you what you've lost is time that you will never get back. The longer you live, the more you realize how precious those moments are. And the more frustrated you'll be at the ones you've wasted. And so it's not just the sluggard who's lazy in the bed. It's the sluggard who spends his whole day looking, craving entertainment and distraction. And I might say that there's even less value in that than this guy who at least is resting his body. He begins something, and even if it's simple, he will not finish it. Chapter 26 and verse 15 says the sluggard buries his hand in the dish. He is weary of bringing it to his mouth again. Again, an exaggeration. But the guy like goes to get a bite. He's like, oh, it's too much. I think about that with our first world problems sometimes. I remember the last time the batteries went out on the remote control. Oh, and we do. We have made ourselves a very lazy culture. And if we're not careful, I think we don't understand the insidiousness of it. Work ethic is quickly becoming just an old traditional fogey sort of a thing. No, it's a godly thing. God expects us to want to work. And he says here, this guy who just can't wait to get to the bed and that's all he wants to do. It's sinister. It's wicked. It is contrary to God. Look back over at chapter 3. Chapter 3 and verse 19. at the connection between work and wisdom. It says there, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, He established the heavens. The idea is God put wisdom into work. And look around you at His work. And see all that He has accomplished. Sometimes we look at the curse in Genesis chapter 3. Towards Adam in particular and the work, the labor. I think the curse is not labor itself. It's not that work must now be done. Work was assigned in the Garden of Eden. That's part of paradise. It's that the work is more aggravating. It's more frustrating now. But the idea of working and accomplishing it, or as Paul points out, working as unto the Lord, that's a blessing. And in fact, if anything, it fights back against the curse. I think laziness is often the curse. It's certainly the way the Proverbs presents it. And if we're not careful in this society, we are working for the weekend, we are working for retirement. I understand that there are jobs we don't like to do, and all we want to do is get them done. I understand that. But if there is no actual work that you can find enjoyment in, there's a problem. There's a problem with your heart. Because God wants us to be workers. And that's a reflection of Him. God is a worker. He puts wisdom to use and He accomplishes all of creation. Well, the family, looking more positively, the family is a major theme throughout the book of Proverbs. Of course, in some sense, it's saturated with the family, maybe in the background. It starts, a father and a mother are instructing the son. And that continues and is repeated over and over. Hear now the instruction. And he talks about, again, the embarrassment. Don't embarrass your mother. Don't bring her to sorrow. It ends in chapter 31 with a mother giving advice to her son on how to find a wife. And so you just see how integrated the notion of family is throughout this book. It even includes romance in the family relationships. Over in chapter 5 and in verse 19, as a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love, that is the wife of your youth, mentioned in verse 18. And so he's rather pointed as far as the relationship of a husband and wife there. Maybe not so much as Song of Solomon, but at least approaching that in that case. There is the element of faithfulness. And the time spent. You look at beginning in chapter 10 and you got snippet, snippet, snippet. You got, you know, all these different subjects. Hit a lick, hit a lick, hit a lick. I don't know that there's anything that is focused on as thoroughly, as intensely as adultery. That idea is hammered home throughout that faithfulness in a marriage. Over and over. And it's equated with other things at times. But the idea, and it's painted so vividly. He even spends a whole chapter telling a story. I'm looking out the window. Let me tell you the story of adultery. Here's this woman. Here's what she looks like. Here's the kinds of words she says. Here's the kind of makeup she puts on. Here's the circumstance that she uses. And here's the kind of person. Here's the kind of young man that she speaks to. And here's his response. And now I'm watching him. And he's going right into the house. And he tells us that story all the way to the young man's death. And shows us where it leads. It's vivid. And so, again, with more focus, it's not a snippet. It's, let me take some time. You know, here's a father. I got a lot to tell you. But think about the importance of that. I'm going to take a lot of time here. I just want to tell you how dangerous and how terrible this is. We were talking about this in our Bible class this morning in the junior high class. And about some of the things the world might agree with or disagree with in the book of Proverbs. The world generally will agree that adultery is a bad thing. They will not necessarily agree it's a horrible thing. It's just you really shouldn't do that. That's not the way the Proverbs writer comes away. It's terrible. It's ruinous in all of these different ways. You can't calculate the ruin that comes from unfaithfulness in the home. And so that's a major theme. of the family. Another major theme of the family, of course, is parenting. And there's a great deal of advice given with regards to parenting. Again, I mentioned in our Bible class this morning about that some people want to soften the verbiage of the book of Proverbs. People come to the book of Proverbs and they see how consistently Proverbs counsels corporal punishment, physical discipline of your children. And it is consistent. And they say, oh, well, that's a shepherding rod. And so what that rod means is you're gently nudging and encouraging them, which is why he says that if you strike him with the rod, he will not die. Yes, because parents are worried about encouraging their children to death. No. He says, you're going to cause them pain and they're going to cry out. It's okay. They'll live. I think I've heard that from my parents. You'll live. Yeah, and I did. And that's what the Proverbs writer is reminding you. Because sometimes you feel like it. Sometimes your kids cry out and it sounds like they're going to die. They're not. They need this. And people say, well, I'm worried. I'm worried about child abuse. I am too. And the Proverbs speak about the relationship that ought to be had and ought to be built between parents and children. But I tell you what, it's worried about another kind of child abuse. That is the abuse of ignoring the discipline of your children. That's what this is worried about. And it's as grave. And it will lead to as grave a consequences. It may not be as visible and certainly not immediately as visible. But they're just as bad. And the evidence is all around us. And so he says, discipline. But along those lines, understand discipline really carries with it the idea of instruction more than punishment. It's the idea of you're teaching them towards something. It's not just you're waiting till they step out of line. The lines that they may not even know are there. And then just pow! No, it's you're teaching them. And that discipline brings them back into line. And really, as you read through the book of Proverbs, the instruction, that is the greatest role of the parent. Too often, I think we forget how full of mush our minds were at one point. But the Proverbs writer reminds us, foolishness, he says, is bound up in the heart of a child, and the rod of discipline will remove it far from him. What we're doing is we're taking children who know, well, literally at the beginning, know nothing. And the question is, when they get to where they know something, who will they have learned it from? You, or just wherever they pick it up? And far too many parents are just waiting to see whatever they pick up on the side of the road, on the side of the internet or the television or wherever else. And so we have to really take charge of that and really be in charge of the instruction, involved in the instruction. And notice how often it is the father who is in charge of that instruction and taking the leading role in the instruction throughout the book of Proverbs. I realize that in many cases, children are with their mothers for far more time. That means you better get busy when you get home, fathers. That means you got time to make up. That you have to be more concerted about that when you're with your children. Don't tune out. And don't get distracted by the world thinking that you need time off. And just say, moms don't get days off. It had not occurred to me all growing up. And then we get married and one of the girls gets sick and the other gets sick and I get sick. And I think, oh no, wait a minute. There's one person who cannot get sick. And thankfully she doesn't very often. And when she does, it's bad. But here, I think dads are so much more willing to take days off, to just tune out, to put distance, and they never have those conversations. I've talked about this before. A lot of pointed conversations. Lots of pointed conversations in the book of Proverbs. Conversations that too many parents aren't willing. It's like they're only willing to speak in the corrective, but not in the instructive. It's like when things get out of hand, yeah, I'm going to have to go talk to him. Yeah, but did you talk to him before? I hear so many parents say, well, they know better than that. And I kind of want to say, well, how? How do you know that? Why do you know that? Did you have a lot of conversations with them about it? Because almost to a person, when I see those situations, no, the conversations have not been had. The instruction has not been given. It's the most important part, most important job that we have. Well, friendships, relationships, maybe more broadly, is a major theme throughout the book of Proverbs. One of the aspects of that is how friends influence us. In Proverbs chapter 13 and in verse 20, he who walks with the wise with wise men will be wise, but the companions of fools will suffer harm. Over in chapter 24 and in verse 1, do not be envious of evil men, nor desire to be with them or to be their companions. This is a principle that we often teach to our children, but I think somehow we think we grow out of it. We do not. You will never stop being influenced by the people that you're around. Because you're saying something when you choose to be around those people. You're saying, I want this company. That in itself is an influence. And you will be further influenced by that. And so we must be careful. I'm talking this morning about personal evangelism, and I realize the need to be around people of the world, but to form close relationships, we must constantly be seeking for people. That's what the church is. Relationships that build one another up, encourage one another daily. And so we want to be thoughtful about that influence. It talks about friends who show love and kindness and forgiveness. Friends who are open and honest with us about our faults and our successes. Friends who are faithful and will be there when they are needed. But all of that, I think, points to an element that's not maybe specifically mentioned, but the instruction points to this. Friends are chosen. Friends are people that you seek out and you decide to cultivate relationships with. I think a lot of people say, well, I don't have many friends. It's because they're sitting and waiting for friends to just fall into their lap. And nobody invites me and nobody talks to me. How many people do you talk to? You know, it's you go see. Often when I have wanted, some of the best friendships I have are people that I have seen and admired and approached. And I've been the one seeking the relationship. And now I have it. And I'm thankful for those relationships. And so you find people who are valuable, who are worth being friends with, and go pursue a relationship with them. That relationship may look different from one person to another. Not everybody's going to relate in the same way. I understand all of that. But friendships are things we work for. Friendships are things we choose to have. And in fact, what we choose to reject. Because that's in there too. Well, words are a major theme. Every time I preach about this, the irony of talking about taking care of how many words we speak is not lost on me. I understand that. There's irony in how many words are in the book that tells you not to use many of them. But the truth is still there. One of the things about the words is not just how many of them you use, but how quickly you speak them. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 25, it is a trap for a man to say rashly, it is holy, and after the vows to make inquiry. You be careful about how quickly, how rashly you speak. When you think back over this last week, can you think back of any words you wish you could have back? If you can't, think harder. There's not a week goes by that I don't say something that I wish, oh, well, now I wish I could reel that back in and at least make some adjustments. Think that before they come out. What we want to do is be thoughtful on the front end of our words and not on the consequence end of our words. And so haste is an element there. Wisdom should precede our words. They should precede our action, certainly, and therefore our words. Over in Proverbs chapter 8, and verse 22, again pointing to the creation of God. The Lord, he says, possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. From everlasting I was established. This is wisdom speaking. From everlasting I was established. From the beginning, from the earliest times of the earth, when there were no depths, I was brought forth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled, before the hills, I was brought forth, while he had not yet made the earth and the fields, nor the first dust of the world. What is he saying? Creation's not here. Nothing we know is here. What is there? Wisdom's still there. The idea is God didn't learn through experience. He got wisdom before he acted, or in fact, I think had wisdom before he acted. Wisdom already existed. And so it is with us that we need to cultivate wisdom before we speak, before we act. And then there is the flip side of words over in Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 28. Not only should we be careful about how we speak, but at the other end of that, there ought to be more listening than speaking. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 28 says there, a false witness will perish, but the man who listens to the truth will speak forever. I like that. The man who listens before he speaks. Well, when he does speak, his words will mean more. They will last longer. They will reverberate years and years after they've been spoken. But the man who just speaks off the top of his head, or worse yet, speaks lies, he'll be soon forgotten. He'll die and his words will die with him. And so we want to be thoughtful. If our words are going to be impactful, then we got to listen to more words than we're speaking. There's a man that's written a lot of books, and I was talking about him with a friend one time, and I said, do you have any of his books? And he said, I just don't trust a man who's written more books than he's read. And indicating he did not have any of his books. That's right. I want a man who's listened a lot more than he's spoken. Finally, there are themes of life and death. I think this one's important. It is important for us to understand the stakes in the book of Proverbs. Life and death. That's the terms he puts it in. You know, this goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, in trusting in these words, understanding what God's saying. There is advice here. God is saying this is the wise path, but so often he adds to that, destruction is in the wings if you don't listen. Life is in the wings if you will listen. And so it's not just the best path, it is the path to destruction or prosperity. There is dichotomy all through the book of Proverbs. It is one direction or the other. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 19. He says, he who is steadfast in righteousness will attain to life. He who pursues evil will bring about his own death. Which direction are you headed? And he tries to spell it out. If this is what your life looks like, you're on the way to death. If this is what your life looks like, you're on the way to life. When I lived in Birmingham, we lived on the north side of Birmingham. I grew up there on the north side of Birmingham. And so Highway 31 runs all the way through Birmingham. And on the north side, it's called Decatur Highway. And on the south side, it's called Montgomery Highway. And I always thought that was peculiar. I wasn't familiar with Decatur. I wasn't familiar with Montgomery. I just assumed that's the name of a road. But as I got older, I realized what it's saying is, this is where you're headed if you're on this road. Sorry, Coleman. You're headed to Decatur. And if you're over there on the south side, you're headed to Montgomery. That's where this road will take you. That's what God is saying here. This is where you are. This is where you're headed. And if you stay this path, that's exactly where you'll end up. And there's no escaping it. And so you choose which path that you're going to take. There's one direction or the other. One other thing about that. Life, even in Proverbs, is found through mercy. Sometimes we miss that in a book like Proverbs, where he's given concrete, practical instruction. And yet throughout, he makes mention of things like this in Proverbs 28 and verse 13. He who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion or mercy, some of your translations will say. over in chapter 16 and in verse 6. By loving kindness and truth, iniquity is atoned for. And by the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil. The ideas of atonement, the ideas of when you have been on the wrong path, here's how to get back on the right path. And incidentally, looks a whole lot like getting back on the right path today. It's not different. It's not the proverb saying if you've messed up, oh well. No. Here's what you do. You confess your transgressions. You recognize and you fear God and you come back to Him. Finally, along those lines, over in Proverbs 29 and verse 1, wherever you're headed, life or death, you will get there more suddenly than you think. A man who hardens his neck after much reproof will suddenly be broken beyond remedy, destroyed beyond remedy, some of your translations will say. There was a fellow writing about World War I, contemporary with those events, and looking back just a few years at the suddenness of it. He couldn't believe how things went from seemingly peaceful to terrible, horrible, indescribable war so quickly. And he said this, "It is as though with a careless remark about the weather, we stumble upon the day of judgment." We're just having conversations. We're going about our business. And here we are. And we're faced with the day of judgment. And if he thought that of that, what will we think about the actual day of judgment? It will be on us before we know. I think an idea about that life is that there is life which is not life. It seems to be headed in the right direction, but Proverbs says it's not. That's death. There is death which is not death. It seems to be disaster or foolishness, but it's not. It's actually headed in the right direction. And of course, Paul picks up that idea in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And Jesus is the ultimate fulfillment of that notion. That there is life through the cross. Through death, through the death of Christ, there is life. And where you think there is life, there is actually death. And so God sets us straight, and what we think is foolish, He shows us is wise, and what we think is wise, He shows us is foolish. And so Jesus is the fulfillment of Proverbs just as surely as He's the fulfillment of all scriptures. Don't make it your aim to follow what will give you more health and wealth. Don't look at the book of Proverbs and say, well, I want more stuff, so I'll follow the advice about money. Even in that, the idea is that it's more of if you will trust in God, you will always be headed in the right direction. And there are caveats in abundance to say, even if you don't have the money, if you have the wisdom, you've got what you need. And so look to this to get you to heaven. Wisdom for salvation, not wisdom just for this world. That's the way Proverbs is headed a lot of times. Wisdom for this world is wisdom to get us to the next. And we can be certain of that. And so don't just live by these things for life improvement. Live for them because God says, this is how to get to me. And so we follow those paths. If you're here this evening and you're not following those paths, you rejected God's wisdom, or maybe you realize there's some value in that. And you think, well, there's something there. Understand that following some of this will only be value here. And just as the proverb says, if you read the whole thing, it says, look, that half-hearted path leads to the same place as the person who's headed there with a brick on the gas pedal. You either give yourself over to God and follow His wisdom all the way there, or don't. But I hope that you might receive that. I hope that you might really consume that instruction this evening. If there's any way we can help you to submit to that authority and begin following that path to life this very evening, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?